The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Today, the Premier League City march on as Chelsea spend some of the time just standing very still. Arsenal lose again, this time at a Glenn Murray-inspired Brighton. Regulation wins for Spurs and Liverpool. And at the bottom, West Brom fail again while Carlos Carvajal's Swansea bring the music. In Spain, new records for Messi and Ronaldo. We'll get a Bundesliga report from Germany. Your questions, feedback corner. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Barry Glendening, so nice to see you.
And you, always a pleasure.
Paul McInnes.
Morning.
How are you?
I'm very well, thanks, yeah.
You bought the coffees?
Yeah, I did. Very generous. A rare moment of generosity from me.
That's very kind of you. We'll tell Ellis. Paolo Bandini, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm good. Do you go to the Super Bowl?
I did go to the Super Bowl.
Oh, did you have a nice time?
I did, yeah. It was a fun trip. I went to the Super Bowl and then took some actual genuine in-season time off afterwards, which is not a thing that I've done. I let someone else write the Monday morning Serie A column for, I think, something like the first time in 10 years. So, yeah, it was a nice break.
Before we get on to the weekend's football, and still with you, Paolo, the very sad news regarding David Astori, Fiorentina's 31-year-old captain, was found dead in his hotel room. Serie A postponed all of yesterday's games in a mark of respect. You wrote a really nice piece in the paper this morning about him and his standing in Italy.
Yeah, he's one of those players who it's sort of... it's strange because I don't feel like, and you can correct me on this if I'm wrong, I don't feel like he would have been a household name outside of Italy previously. I don't think that your average English football fan would have known who Astori was. And yet in Italy, he was a very well-respected player. He was someone who hadn't necessarily played for most of his career at the very, very top clubs. He had one season at Roma, most recently 3 years at Fiorentina, and made the captain at the beginning of the season. So, and a good player, and I think you can obviously vouch for that in the statistical way of saying, oh, he played 14 games for Italy, which is not something everyone gets to do, played 289 Serie A games. But I think it's almost the fact that those games he played for Italy were spread across such a long period of time. 2011, the first one, 2017, the last one. He certainly would have been in squads going forward at this point of his career when they get round to appointing a new manager. And I think it's really sort of a testament to him at this period when we've had Bonucci, Chiellini, Barzagli, all these great defenders, that even if he wasn't in the team with Italy, he was someone who they always wanted to have around. I think that speaks to who he was as a teammate as well as who he was as a player. He's the kind of individual who just helps a squad, who is a presence that is positive. And I think that's the thing that's come out so much in all the tributes to him. He was someone who was just a really optimistic, great guy to have around.
And tributes from everyone.
It's extraordinary. Some of the people who've been paying tribute. I think you look at people like David Beckham, Sergio Ramos, the sort of names you don't necessarily, again, expect for someone who isn't a household name outside of his own country. But within Italian football, I think you see the powerful comments made by people like Gigi Buffon and then Antonio Conte, obviously. Visibly, I would say, not in himself almost for the game against City at the weekend. So he's someone who touched a lot of lives, and you know, I find it very hard to talk about these things because it's not it's not the fact of who he was as a footballer that's tragic about this. It's the fact that he's a 31-year-old who had a partner and a kid and was just a young guy in the prime of his life, enjoying his life and his career, and it's very hard to explain how this stuff happens. They'd had at Fiorentina, we don't know the circumstances of his death yet, but we know at Fiorentina they'd had on Wednesday, last Wednesday, the whole squad did blood tests, they did cardiograms. They're really quite on top of this stuff in Italy. They're quite on top of trying to make sure that we don't see people lost in this way, because it's happened before, and it's just really hard to come to terms with something like that.
Yeah, well, beautifully said and very well put in the paper as well today. And trite it is, to move on to the football. It's what we're here to do. Manchester City 1, Chelsea 0. City now 4 wins away from the title. Chelsea now 5 points off 4th place. Paul Barney writes a piece in the paper today saying that in the opening hour, City made 628 passes, a pass every 6 seconds. Just watching from the sidelines is enough to make one go cross-eyed.
I mean, they are dominating the ball quite heavily. I don't always see them as being another universe apart. I think teams like Liverpool, Spurs, they like to dominate possession as well. But what was striking about this game was that Chelsea were quite happy to let them do that, and in fact were encouraging them to do that. And they were, you know, pretty much parking the bus in the manner you might expect a Stoke or a Southampton to do.
Is that a worry that on paper the fifth best team, the champions of last year, are approaching it in that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. If only for what it says about the current relationship between Antonio Conte and the hierarchy at Chelsea. I mean, I was at his press conference on Friday, and he was quite happy to extol the virtues of Manchester City because it enabled him to make the point that they have a very, very good coach, but they've also spent lots and lots of money. And it's getting incredibly boring now to hear this from Conte about how he doesn't get to spend money on the players he wants. And, you know, he in fact won't even accept responsibility for the players he has signed. He will say, that's the club's decision, nothing to do with me. And you think that, you know, what he said after the match was that he set up the team to contain Manchester City because that was, you know, otherwise they could have got beaten 3 or 4 nil. So he's sending out a clear signal that he doesn't think his team are good enough to compete, and you get the feeling that his players kind of believe that too. That said, it was a 1-0 defeat. Had they counter-attacked a bit more effectively than the way they actually did, they had 2 or 3 occasions in the second half in particular where they had men over, but their final ball was awful, then, you know, it could have been different.
Yeah, I guess that's sort of my one sort of... I think with Conte, the problem almost for me is when you start to look at it in the broader narrative of recent weeks rather than just this game, that it becomes more problematic. The idea of going to City and taking a more cautious approach, I mean, I think about their game against Barcelona in the Champions League. They were cautious and they kept back. And actually, if it wasn't for one bad pass by Christensen...
That's not true. I don't think that's true. I think they were more assertive in that game against Barcelona than they were against Chelsea.
They
certainly created more chances.
Definitely. They did create more chances. I think that speaks to the relative qualities of City and Barcelona personally right now. But they did not press Barcelona up the pitch. They drew back into their half and they had these sort of tight banks and they said, play through us. That's what they challenged them to do. It's just that City are much more effective at it than Barcelona.
They didn't create that many chances. So it nearly worked.
But in the, you know, there is that
it
clip
wasn't good to look at.
In the 74th minute, I think it is, there's a thing that's gone viral now of Chelsea not pressing at all, and they're 1-0 down with 15 minutes to go.
Yeah, it was the passive nature of it was strange, and I've seen the clip you're talking about, and Chelsea's players basically resemble training cones, you know, and you're wondering, they're presumably acting on instructions, but there seems to be a strange lack of pride among them. You know, no one's getting stuck in. There's no intensity whatsoever. Antonio Conte waited a very long time before making any changes in personnel. And I found it weird. The tactics he employed served them fairly well up to a point. But you'd think with 15 minutes to go, right, we might as well try and get an equaliser, because even if we do lose 3-0, it doesn't really matter, does it? You know, we're not going to get a hiding if there's only 15 minutes left. But yeah, I found those... I understood the tactics. I would imagine they're not the kind of tactics Roman Abramovich wants to see employed by a team he owns. But yeah, the manner and the lack of intensity I found puzzling.
Yeah, I mean, I think the team selection and the substitutions are definitely perplexing to me, even having just defended the sort of the tactics. I find it very odd that in a game where you know you're wanting to play in this counter-attacking way, that you don't make more use of a guy like Alvaro Morata, who is a sensational counter-attacking player. I mean, that's what he does best, is stretch games and use his pace. And meanwhile, you've got Hazard up there who doesn't really look like he knows what his job is, and having long balls pumped forward towards him who's sort of looking like he's in the wrong place. I think that the team selection was definitely perplexing to me, and yeah, especially the leaving it so late, as you say, to make those changes.
I think he's not been particularly vociferous in his defence of Morata recently, which is odd. You know, before Christmas he was, you know, he's bigging him up, but he's talking about how Morata needs to do the work to get through the slump, rather than he's a great player, he'll come good. And you know, he brought Giroud on before him off the bench, but. There's the cynical conspiratorial way of looking at this is, you know, he wants to get sacked. Like, he knows it's over. He's not going to get the resolution of the monies that he wants. And the only way he's going to get the payoff is if he gets sacked.
Christopher writes, the City team this year is likely to be the best the Premier League has ever seen. Are we not celebrating this fact enough? Once again, we've sort of talked about this game and we're just focusing on the tactics of Antonio Conte and not the sheer marvel of all the City people.
I think we've waxed lyrical about how City are a joy to watch and sort of had discussions about reconciling that with the fact that they're owned by these terrible people. It's a discussion we've had many times.
Do we worry, Barry, that City will dominate forever and there'll never be a title race ever again?
Yeah, I would. They basically built this fantastic club and tailored it to Pep Guardiola's specific needs, and as long as he is there, I would imagine no one's going to get near them.
That's the question, isn't it? I mean, the idea, I think those who know him best suggest that he's willing to hang on for longer than they initially thought, that he's going to do a five-year, he'll sign a new contract at the end of the season, he's done for long to see the project through. But that's a five-year project rather than a three-year project. What happens after 5 years? You know, you look at Man United, you look at, you know, Fergie obviously having great success over a far longer period of time, but it's difficult to change.
You imagine that when Pep does leave, he won't then just be in the stands for every City game so the camera can pan to Pep and say, it's not going very well, is it, Sam Allardyce or whoever's there? City play Basel on Wednesday night. They're 4-0 up. So, I mean, you can watch it if you want to, but can't imagine. I mean,
well, you want to talk about how good they are to watch. Watch it just. Well, I was about to say, watch for the joy of watching players like Leroy Sané, who I thought was sensational again at the weekend. But will he actually play? Because you're 4-0 up, maybe not.
On that Sané thing.
Phil Foden, might
they? Yeah. On that Sané thing, he is now the form man. You know, De Bruyne was for ages. But the key is to win all the awards. You have to be really good at the start because then we all stop sort of concentrating. But is our Sané now better than De Bruyne?
I think better is a little bit abstract for me, but he's playing. He's playing as well as anyone in the Premier League right now, yeah.
Brighton 2, Arsenal 1. Should we start with Brighton? I mean, I don't know how long it'll be before we start talking about Arsene Wenger, but at least try. They are 10th, only 7 points off the relegation zone, but lots of positives, Paul McInnes.
Yeah, the main positive being I think they're on 34 points now.
Mm-hmm.
So two more wins for 40, which is probably going to be more than enough to stay up. They've got some tricky fixtures to come. They play most of the top six, but they've got at least a couple of home games where Brighton have done very well at home this season. The thing about Brighton is they've got better over the course of the season, particularly at home. Their attacking play, Houghton is cautious, we all know that, but he wants his teams to play. It's just not take that much risk. You've got to play effectively. And since Ezquierdo's come into form, since Ezquierdo has sealed his place in the team, him, Knockhart, Murray, they're a very effective attacking combination. But they've also got that physical resilience, strength that, you know, gets you out of the Championship and does a job in the Premier League. And they really set about Arsenal on Sunday and asserted themselves on the game.
Sam asks, how many goals will Glenn Murray score at the World Cup?
He's doing very well, actually. I've sort of been compiling a list, maybe with a view to doing an article of potential dark horses that Gareth Southgate should bring to the World Cup but won't. And I don't think Murray's quite there, but he's having an excellent season because he's one of those players I've always thought is kind of in the Cameron Jerome mode, who's a good Championship player, not quite good enough for the Premier League. But he's done well this season. I think Brighton smelt blood yesterday and went, these guys are here for the taking, tore into them. I think if they'd had a little bit more pace up front, they could have won by a lot more. But having said that, when Arsenal got it back to 2-1, I thought, oh, they'll win this. Arsenal will win. And they gave a good account of themselves maybe for the first 15 minutes of the second half and then just kind of gave up. But I'm interested, actually, Paul, because I think Chris Hughton has matured as a manager and found a good balance of, you know, risk and caution. And I'm curious to know what parallels, if any, do you draw between this Brighton team and the Norwich team he managed? And I think quite a lot of Norwich fans were unhappy with him.
Yeah, I mean, they're
pleased to see the back of him.
Yeah, they're idiots. He was a great manager. He is a great manager. But, you know, in the Premier League, when you're a small club, it's not a bad decision to try and be safety first. You know,
was he too safety first?
That's what a lot of the fans thought. But what happened was he got the second season. He got money to spend on attacking reinforcements. He spent it on Ricky van Wolfswinkel and Leroy Fer, and they didn't, you know, really deliver. And Robert Snodgrass, who had been excellent the season before, wasn't as good. Our attacking options. We bought Gary Hooper as well. He was a good striker. Well, Johan Elman bought three strikers. They couldn't really play together. So there was problems with the transfer dealings, I think, that sort of stopped us from taking that next step on that season. I wanted to make a point about Brighton. Pascal Gross, Jose Izquierdo, Davy Proper, Matt Ryan, all signed in the summer. They've all been excellent acquisitions, you know, up there with the best in the league. You know, their recruitment's been really strong. And I think that might be the difference. I don't think he ever quite got to prove it. But it's, you know, he's going to be quite happy to go away from home in the Premier League and try and keep a clean sheet and get a point. And some fans don't. Some fans want more than that. But at the end of the day, when you are a bottom 10 side in the Premier League, that sort of behaviour is going to keep you in the division.
You mentioned Robert Snodgrass. We should say that he has escaped the Snodgrass vortex, really. He's doing quite well, I think, for Aston Villa at the moment. And lovely that Shane Duffy assisted Lewis Dunk's goal, because they're sort of two talisman for Brighton, aren't they? And Arsenal, Paolo. Their 10th defeat of the season. They've lost more than 10 in just one season under Wenger. That was in 2005-06. They managed to finish fourth in that season. They're not going to finish fourth this year. 34th minute, we want Wenger out. 43rd minute, they were ironically chanting, we've scored a goal. Petr Cech tweeted afterwards, if you want to win a game away from home in the best league in the world, your goalkeeper can't concede two goals like I did today. It's not possible. The team fought back, but the damage was done. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, to a certain extent, it is and has been for a long time hard to add something fresh to this, because what haven't we said already? I think that, talk about sort of damning statistics, I think the fact this is only the second time ever under Wenger that Arsenal have lost four games in a row, it is starting to feel cumulative in a way that perhaps it hasn't before. There's no respite from this. There was no... I don't know. There was no shock in losing away to Brighton. I think that's the thing. There was no longer a sense of, oh, Arsenal shouldn't be losing away to a team like Brighton. It was, yeah, Arsenal lose away to teams like Brighton the way they play at the moment. And yes, Cech made mistakes. Yes, as Baz said, Arsenal with a little bit better finishing could actually have come back into this game. They wouldn't have deserved it, but they could have done. And I think everyone feels like the tipping point arrived a while ago. I think it's sad that Wenger didn't ride off after winning an FA Cup, which he could have done and had a positive out. But I think at this point, it's hard to imagine him stepping away. I think he's like lots of managers in that regard. How many managers do you really know who's taken an honourable stance and say, I'm going to resign because I'm not doing the job well enough? And what's the problem, and has been the problem for a long time, is the absolute void of leadership beyond that. I mean, where were the even club directors at this game yesterday, at the time when the club is struggling and you want to see someone taking control, where were they? Where is even Gazidis? What's he doing? It's a club without leadership.
I thought the lack of leadership on the field as well was remarkable. There's nobody, not a single person on that team trying to grab the game by the scruff of the neck. And in the last 10 minutes, nobody wanted to take responsibility and try and make something happen. Everyone was just... didn't want to be the guy, the next guy to make a mistake. And that's weird to see. There's no confidence there whatsoever.
Looked like Kolasinac wanted to make a mistake by trying to take that guy's head off. Yeah. You've done some Stan Kroenke research, Barry.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking, you know, every week we have the same conversation about Arsenal. I was trying to bring something new to the party. So, you know, Stan Kroenke has four teams in the USA. He has the Colorado Rapids football team, St. Louis Rams, LA Rams, they were originally in St. Louis, Colorado Avalanche in the NHL, and his basketball team, the Denver Nuggets. And they're all terrible. And under his...
Well, the Rams were great this year.
Were they?
The Rams for the...
Well, it was their first playoff since 2004.
They were. And you know, if we want to do the clinging for parallels for Arsenal fans, the reason it happened was because they got rid of a coach who had hung on too long in mediocrity and hired a young, upstart who had a fantastic season. So there you go. There's your positive spin to put on it, if you wanted to, which I know is not the way you were going.
Yeah. The Rapids were second last in the Western Conference last season. Colorado Avalanche in the NHL, fifth of seven in the Central Division, and the Nuggets were 9th of 15 in the Western Conference, failed to make the playoffs.
Sorry,
the Nuggets.
I'm just stuck on when they're sitting around going, what happened in Denver? Was there like gold panning?
Presumably.
Or just a lot of chicken? It's one of the two. But like, Nugget is quite often something I get called on Twitter, and I don't think it's positive.
But basically, all Kroenke's teams seem to just slide into irrelevance once he takes over, and he doesn't seem to care. Powder. So it's worrying for Arsenal fans.
Who do the Arsenal cognoscenti, the Guna cognoscenti, want as manager right now? Presumably not Tuchel anymore.
I don't know that I'm in with the Arsenal cognoscenti, but there's so many great names of managers. If you wanted to start saying people who could potentially be up for this job, it's an attractive job. It's going to be a job that promises you a bigger budget than many clubs in the world can offer, that promises you the drawing power despite these recent seasons other clubs can't offer. I know that the name Max Allegri has been kicking around for a long time, if he'd ever actually decided to walk away from Juventus, where he has a very good thing going. I know there was some talk I had over the weekend of, you know, maybe it could be time for someone like Joachim Löw to dip back into something like this. I don't know that there's one name that's sort of standing out above the others. I think there's a whole host of very talented managers, and I think they would expect someone of the very, very top level with an established sort of record of succeeding clubs like this, which is funny because, yes, as I just sort of alluded to, Sean McVay, the guy who they hired for the Rams, turned around as a 30-year-old youngest coach ever in the NFL.
Regulation wins for Liverpool and Spurs. Liverpool 2, Newcastle 0. I mean, these games were actually quite similar. Spurs 2, Huddersfield 0 as well, which were, they sort of resembled training games where I think Newcastle contributed more in the Liverpool game than Huddersfield did in the Spurs game. I also think Liverpool attacked with a bit more dynamism than Spurs did in the Spurs game.
I was at Spurs and I was impressed by their attacking. I thought they were good. I've seen them have stodgy opening halves this season and I thought they were on it.
I was at Spurs as well and I thought this was a bit insipid everywhere. They did break quickly, but they did all they needed to do.
They did. But I mean, I thought Son was on his game from minute one. I think Ali gets he gets an awful lot of focus. And I think he's always willing to get involved in both sides of the game. And I thought he was making contributions. Harry Kane was slightly off. Eriksen was maybe a little bit quieter. But I thought, Son did enough to win the match by himself.
Mark says, is Son the most underrated player in the Premier League? More goals this season than Sanchez, Sane, Mane and Lacazette.
I don't think he's underrated at all. Just thinking, like if the Spurs Player of the Year award was to be handed out now, voted by the fans, I'm guessing Harry Kane would win it at a canter. But there are I can think of at least four live contenders off the top of my head. You know, Eriksen, Son, Kane, goalkeeper, Loris,
Pat Jennings, Ray Clements,
Moussa Dembele. You know,
yeah, there's a lot of contenders. And maybe Son was underrated a season ago, but I think everyone values his contribution. You know, he was expected not to be there. You know, there was talk they were going to sell him. Was it last season? And because there wouldn't be a place for him in the team, but he's made himself absolutely indispensable.
There was a very good moment in the 88th minute, or it was near the end, where there was a sort of well-worked corner and Kane found himself in a lot of space directly from the corner and volleyed it wide. And quite a grumpy Spurs fan three rows behind me just shouted, "Kane, you're rubbish!" with no irony at all.
His
cross was remarkable, wasn't it?
Well, I said to you yesterday, it was like a golfer stuck behind a tree trunk and the manner in which he just dug it out and around, it was...
And just the vision to do that as well, you know?
Yeah.
And a great header from Son, actually.
I think you can't value this enough, but he's one of these players, you suspect he's really low maintenance, you know? I would imagine, turns up on time, trains like a demon, looks after himself. He's not going to be falling out of nightclubs. He's not going to get in trouble. You know, he's not going to be on the front page of the tabloids. And those players like that are worth their weight in gold, you know.
Have you ever literally fallen out of a nightclub?
No. Oh. I did nearly. And I was thinking, what a way to go it could have been. just I, you know, when you're putting on a sock,
yeah,
but you're doing no, I think I was putting on my boxers or something, but I got my foot caught and sort of hopped across. I came.
Is this this morning?
No. This is like a couple of months ago.
Okay. But came in a club.
Perilously close to, like,
in a nightclub, yeah.
Falling out my bedroom window. And I would have been, like, found dead on the footpath outside my house with
one foot in
my boxers and the other not. I mean, the absolute embarrassment of
legend.
But it nearly happened.
I suspect. When you do go, that'll be how. Liverpool's win over Newcastle. Same again, Paul. I mean, I just thought it was regulation. I don't know if we should be worried that this is how the Premier League is right now. Or it's tough for those sides going away from home to bigger clubs with more money and better players.
It's interesting. I've got a friend who's a big Newcastle fan, and he's sort of very, very strident in his support of Benitez. And I think some people have been critical in the same way, although, of course, with very different expectations of the way he's approached games like this, in the same way as Conte, perhaps, through the game against City. You know, you're approaching these games with a let's just draw it back and keep things tight, and even maybe after going behind, not throwing things forward kind of mentality. And, you know, my friend's perspective on it is that is the reality down the bottom end of the table. Newcastle have wound up with a pretty decent goal difference out of it, and you try and make your points where you expect to make them, not against Liverpool. Yeah, you know, it's not thriller minute stuff to watch, but to a certain extent, yes, there is a big gulf now between the teams at the top and the teams at the bottom, and that is how it is.
I did think the difference between that and Huddersfield really thought they were going to lose. I don't think they were trying to keep it tight and play for a point. I thought they thought, well, this is a game where it doesn't matter whether we get points or not.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I can understand the approach of teams like Huddersfield and Newcastle in games like that, but it doesn't make for a very good league, because, you know, Burnley have just won their first match in 12 in the league and no one's overtaken them. You know, they're still seventh. And that's not a sign of a good quality of team, you know, below Burnley. Burnley aren't that good. They are pretty good. They're seventh. They deserve to be seventh. But the fact that they've only won one game in 12 and nobody has overtaken them is a fairly worrying sign of very poor quality.
But this is the best league in the world.
But it, no, it isn't.
What is?
Championship.
For entertainment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's competitive. It's,
you know,
the Championship isn't better than the Premier. It's not better, is it?
Well, define better.
Right, I mean, this is, you know, better is one of these sort of nonsense words that go around. Yeah, I mean, the Premier League has the most money and therefore signs many of the best players. If you want a competitive title race and a competitive Champions League race and a competitive all the way through, I'll make my case for Serie A. What's the best? I'm not going to say it's got the best, some of the best players. It's got some incredible players, but of course the Premier League gets to hoover up talent because Premier League clubs are spending hundreds of millions of pounds.
Good point. That's right.
Champions League action then, involving Italian side Juve. They go to Spurs. How have Juve been getting on since the first leg?
I mean, same as. They actually had a really big weekend. Obviously, the Astori news was the headline news in Italy, but that happened on Sunday morning. Before that, we had these two games on Saturday night. Juventus won away to Lazio. Lazio had beaten them twice already this season. Lazio outplayed them for 93 minutes. And then Paulo Dybala, who has only making his first start since returning from a hamstring injury in January, just scores a brilliant goal out of nothing. He hadn't had a good game, but he just turned two men, held off someone else who was basically mauling him in the penalty area and put it in the roof of the net. And that is maybe the one most encouraging thing for them ahead of the Spurs game, is having Paulo Dybala back, because they have got some injuries. It's not at all certain that Higuain's going to be able to play in this game. But Dybala, as we saw in last season's run to the final, when he is firing, which he hasn't been for a good part of the season, even before he got injured, but when he is firing, he is a sensational talent. So, big weekend for them. They won 1-0. Napoli then lost, which means Juventus are back in the driving seat, if technically not yet first, because of a game in hand in Serie A.
And you play Dybala wide, he could get joy against the Tottenham fullbacks. I mean, Aurier played badly in Turin.
Yeah, I mean, it's been interesting. It'll be interesting to see how Juventus do line up. It'll depend in part on injuries. It was interesting as well to note that against Lazio, even though it was a huge game in the title race, Allegri actually rested a bunch of players. He didn't start Alexandro, he didn't start Douglas Costa, he didn't start Giorgio Chiellini. All of this clearly with an eye on the Tottenham game.
Is Matuidi fit?
Yep. Should be. The question of how he lines up is definitely not settled, because in recent games he's you know, used a 4-3-3, he's used a 3-5-2, he's chopped and changed. You certainly can play Dybala through the middle. You can have him leading the line. He's done it before. But yes, you could equally play him out wide in a 4-3-3, let Mandzukic play through the middle, assuming Higuain doesn't come back from this ankle injury, which he might. So definitely options for Juventus. Clearly, 2-2 in the first leg was a great result for Tottenham, so they're in the driving seat. But Juventus are... They haven't conceded a goal in Serie A so far in 2018, which is pretty extraordinary when you think they're playing teams as good as Lazio.
Liverpool play Porto on Tuesday night. They're 5-0 up, so that looks like they can rest a few people. And the only other side, we haven't mentioned the top four, Manchester United, they go to Crystal Palace tonight. Very big game for Crystal Palace. I was at the London Football Awards last week, and the voting for that, for Manager of the Year, is about 4 weeks ago. So Roy Hodgson won Manager of the Year for London football team. Is difficult. I imagine Pochettino, you know, when you get to the end of the season, would probably get it. But it could be quite awkward that he wins that and they go down, because essentially Crystal Palace win when Wilfried Zaha is fit and they don't when he isn't. Is that too simple?
I mean, largely they do. Well, the injury list has gone down from 12 to 10 for this game.
Who's back?
Jeffrey Schlupp and Martin Kelly. So they've got a little bit more defensive reinforcement. But last time Palace beat United was in May 1991 in the league.
Really?
Yeah, wow. Ian Wright scored.
England's hopes, by the way, of fast-tracking new possible player Scott McTominay to a depressing and unrewarding England career have been dashed as he's chosen Scotland.
With a name like that, who'd have thought?
Which would be just as depressing and unrewarding, but at least his summers will be free.
Yeah. And in other Manchester United news, Jose Mourinho is a pundit for this summer's World Cup for Russia Today.
I saw that. Ugh. That's the Kremlin's propaganda arm, mate.
Colin Moore and Jose, some bants on there.
Yikes.
And that'll do for part one. We'll be back in a sec. Welcome back to Guardian Football Weekly, the relegation battle, gentlemen. Watford 1, West Brom 0. Last week we were told that Pardew had one game to save his job. But it turns out he's got more than that, mainly because no one else really wants it, or they can't find anyone to fill it. They're playing Leicester next. Were they unlucky, Barry, this game?
I don't think so. I saw Pardew being interviewed after the game without having seen the game, and he seemed to think they'd been very hard done by and deserved at least a point, if not all three. And I kind of took that at face value. And I think it was Johnny Evans or Chris Brunt said much the same thing. One Northern Ireland international sounds much the same as another. But one of them said similar thing. And then I saw the highlights of Match of the Day and went, this bears no relation to the game they seem to have been talking about. You know, I thought Watford had far more chances. West Brom had, you know, some desperate defending. Ben Foster had to make a couple of good saves. Kieran Gibbs had to block a shot in the line. And, you know, they could have scored. Maybe a point would have been fair enough, but certainly didn't think they looked superior. Now, obviously, I only saw highlights, and you can edit them to make a team look as good or as bad as you want to be. But, you know, Troy Deeney's excellent winner. I thought I couldn't see how West Brom could have too many complaints.
Paul, are West Brom the worst squad in the league?
No, absolutely not. I mean, you know, Newcastle have a worse squad than West Brom. Their recruitment was bad in the summer. They bought good players, but not the positions they needed. They're not alone in the Premier League in not having an effective striker. It's difficult. You know, Stoke, Southampton, similar positions. But, you know, they've got a lot of experienced professionals out there and they should not be in the position they're in. And I have to say, I just don't know what... I don't know what they were doing sacking Tony Pulis. I mean...
Did you always think that, or are you...
Yeah, I mean, I did. Like, last year I wanted to write a piece which was like, you know, in praise of Tony Pulis, because I felt that I watched him a few times and Matt Phillips was on form at the time. And I thought he was interchanging with Rondon pretty well, Brunt on the other side. I was like, yeah, okay, I understand how a Pulis attacking football might work. It's still going to be very conservative, but it's quick, it's strong, it's not that bad. And this season, they're obviously in bad form. And the fans weren't happy. Now, I think there's a whole debate you can have about what fans expect, what fans want, and what fans should get. Put that to one side. They were in bad form. But who are you going to trust to turn that around and keep the club in the division? I think they were a bit too cocky about what position they were in and how secure their Premier League status was. You know, Pulis does not take teams down, and they are going down.
Someone on Match of the Day, one of the pundits, I can't remember who, but made the point that any time they go forward, the runners from midfield are just 10 yards behind where they should be. They're not quick enough. And you can't see them getting out of this. They look absolutely doomed. I mean, Rondon, Sunderland pulled off, you know, I think their most famous great escape. Conor Wickham hit form and scored 5 or 6 goals in as many games. And you can't see anyone at West Brom doing that. You know, Rondon missed an absolute sitter on against Watford, header, I think, on the worst header of a footballer round. I think even I'd have scored that one. And you can't see. He works hard. He's a good player, but he's not prolific. He's not going to get enough goals to get them out of this mess. And this is a mess.
If the league started when Pardew took over, the top five of Man City, Spurs, Liverpool, Manchester United and Chelsea would still make the top five. Sixth and seventh would be Swansea and West Ham. And I'm all in favour, just to mix it up, of football seasons only being active when Alan Pardew gets jobs and stopping when Alan Pardew gets fired. And Swansea beat West Ham 4-1 to overtake them in the league on goal difference. Carlos Carvajal, who is a breath of fresh air, isn't he, Paolo, said they brought the music.
Yeah, rock and roll football. Yeah, I mean, they're fun to watch at the moment, which is, you know, which is something. I mean, I think they got West Ham, you could say, perhaps at a good moment, missing a couple of starting centre-backs and losing Winston Reid as well during the game. But Swansea are just a delight to watch at the moment. They're fun.
Am I the only person that missed Andy King moving to Swansea?
Yeah, I'd forgotten about it too. He went on deadline day, I think. But that's a sensible purchase. And actually, what's quite interesting is, you know, Swansea got a load of stick for their summer window performance. Actually, January, they were quite cute. And, you know, selling Andre Ayew to your relegation rival in the middle of the season, I just that's bad decision making as far as I'm concerned. He obviously played like, you know, his life depended on it. He combined it with his brother. Also, Ki Sun-yeong had a great game, who West Ham had tried to poach in the January window. So there was lots of sort of animus going on there.
There's something extra great about watching the fact they're siblings. I know that it's dumb, but it is. I mean, you talk about rock and roll, you know, you got your, hopefully that means we get a brilliant sort of Gallagher brother style falling out at some point and it'll all go, but it's
I thought you were saying they might do like a musical number at the end of the season. Since Carvajal took over, Swansea have only won 3 points fewer than Manchester City in that time. I mean, it's remarkable what he's done, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think everyone was quite sceptical when he got the job. It was a sort of, because he hadn't... he was well-liked at Sheffield Wednesday, but, you know, when they got rid of him, things weren't going well.
So, like, I don't know how long this lasts for a manager, but I think there's this massively underestimated element in football for a manager of just... Can you make a group of people who, especially, you know, nowadays when everyone's making plenty of money, can you make these people genuinely just enjoy coming and doing this, like having fun together?
Yeah.
And the brother thing does play into that to a certain extent. I mean, it depends how well you get on with your brother. But I know that actually, even though me and my brother, for instance, might have fallen out at times, playing football on the same team as him was always fun. Like, it was always like, okay, this is sort of a fun thing to do. And I just think all of it, like the sense of him and him as a character, you see him, the way he gives interviews, the fact that he talks about putting the music out there on the pitch, he's giving off an energy which I think right now is making it work for this team. I think it's making everyone think, great, going to work isn't going to work, it's going to play football and have a laugh.
But he's also changed, you know, he's a renowned tactician, and he's made Swansea more solid. You know, he's gone to a back three, he's drafted in this, you know, guy, Mike van der Hoorn, who wasn't getting a game at all. I benched him for my fantasy team on Saturday, obviously, scores a goal, 10 points. But, you know, what that does is it also takes Norton and Olsen out of liability positions at fullback. Puts them at wing back. They're better going forward. It makes them less susceptible. That's that sort of sensible decision making that has built a platform for them to go on. I mean, they still could get relegated, but.
But I don't think you can overestimate how bad they were when he took over. I mean, remember the first time Ellis was in here, he was in despair, you know, and he had accepted relegation. You know, they were an absolute shambles. And with only a couple of changes in personnel, Carvajal has just shown the benefits, what can be done with just good coaching. He said after this game, you know, when someone asked him, what's your secret? He said, hard work, correct mistakes, change formation, correct more mistakes. And it can be done.
Talking of buying siblings, Donnarumma, didn't Milan buy his brother in the summer?
And during the period when everything was going sour at Milan, fans hung a massive banner accusing him of being a parasite, his brother. Subsequent to that, actually wound up having to start a couple of games because of injury and played really well. So, Milan is kind of another example for me of case in point with can you make the players sort of enjoy what they're doing, because that squad has not fundamentally changed from the one that was doing horribly. Gattuso's made some smart tactical decisions, but I don't think he's reinvented the wheel. What he has brought back is a sense of enthusiasm, and I think that goes a long way for professional footballers. I think people underestimate it.
And do we think that Christian Benteke isn't having a really great time because his brother Jonathan moved to Oldham from Crystal Palace because they weren't having so much fun. And the Nevilles were always smiling when they were on the pitch, weren't they?
Thorgan Hazard, is he still a Chelsea player on loan at some Bundesliga team?
It's a very good question. Borussia. No, says what's the producer Jonathan.
What's the highest number of brothers they've had in one team? Well, wasn't there three Steens at Luton?
Yeah.
There were five Van Dykes in one episode of Diagnosis Murder.
Right. Okay.
How many Wallaces at Southampton?
Oh, I think
just two.
Danny, Rodney, and was there another one? I think there was.
Was there a
Ray?
Ray, yes, there was a third Wallace. Mm. But we can't go bigger than five Van Dykes. But that didn't span just brothers and sisters.
Yeah. But Diagnosis Murder.
Dick was there.
Diagnosis Murder is to be the most nepotistic.
It's worse than the Trump administration.
Yeah. Because if you go on IMDb and look up what all the other Van Dykes, apart from Dick, have done, they've done very little.
But not only that, it was almost like the nepotism actually played out in the plot, in as much as his son was like the head of police, right, but never solved the flipping crime because his dad always came in as a doctor and solved the crime for him. He was incompetent.
You guys have watched a fair bit of Diagnosis Murder, well, it turns out.
Mainly because it was far more exciting than Southampton 0, Stoke 0. Stoke are 19th, 27 points. Southampton are 17th on 28 points. Interestingly, the bottom three of Palace, Stoke and West Brom are the last three teams Tony Pulis managed before, obviously, his current job at Middlesbrough. Does anyone have anything exciting to say about Stoke 0 at Southampton? Or
no, not really. I mean, that they are incredibly well matched. Since Lambert's come in, I think he's only won once and lost once. The rest have been draws, and that's exactly the same results that Pellegrino has had at Southampton during the same time. They, you know,
the thing is, Lambert at Stoke, they have squandered 5 points, I think.
Last minute penalty and
I think in the first four games, they threw away 5 points, and that could prove very costly indeed.
So Palace are 18th. They've got that game tonight against Manchester United. Newcastle 16th, Huddersfield 15th. We've covered them. Above them, Bournemouth won all at Leicester. It was a brilliant free kick from Riyad Mahrez. And the way everyone celebrated seemed to imply that people won't be angry with Riyad Mahrez if he does something really good.
I think it's a tricky thing that Claude Puel's got to pull off, but a lot of managers are going to have to think about this in the same way over time. When your prize asset gets tapped up, or you know, not tapped up in an illegal sense, but courted, then you're going to have to get them back on board because you need them. And if you do get them back on board, then it seems like fans are willing to accept that, as long as they're seeing somebody trying on the pitch, it seems. And that's what he's been doing this season.
Any sympathy for Bournemouth? I mean, they should have had another penalty when Charlie Daniels was pushed over in the box. No sympathy, Barry?
Not really. Oh, I think the free kick they gave away was silly. You know, there was no need for the Steve Cook foul on Iheanacho. And then Adam Smith should have been in the wall but wasn't. And it was a great strike. I mean, I think a point each, they'll both be happy enough with that.
Good away point for Bournemouth.
Burnley 2, Everton 1, Burnley's first win since December. The first time Sean Dyche has led Burnley to a win after conceding the first goal, which is an interesting stat. And also worth noting that, that's in the Premier League, by the way, also worth noting that they're only 5 points behind Arsenal now. So they could go on a good run. Would that get European football sixth? It probably would, wouldn't it?
Yeah, because Man City won
the FA Cup winner, but
Man City won Carabao, so it would go.
Oh, yeah.
Andrew Tate says, who will finish next season as Everton manager? My thinking is Rafa Benitez.
I mean, yeah. I mean, Marco Silva is will be available in the summer. I mean, it's funny. I mean, I like Sam, and I was very impressed with what he did at both Sunderland and Palace. But this does appear to be bigger club, different expectations. They want you to play football, and he's struggling. They could have, you know, if they'd have won, I think they would have gone the same points as Burnley. It would have been, you know, they would be the ones closing in on the top six. Now, doesn't look like so much, but that's quite, and it's, you know, it's quite a disappointing performance.
Well, they've lost six in a row away from home now. Everton fans do not like Sam, don't want him there. I'd have a speculative punt on Mikel Arteta being their manager at the end of next season. I think he's a good manager waiting to happen, you know, and he's learning from the best. So apparently he's been linked with Arsenal as well. That might be too big a job for him in his first managerial role, but could certainly see him taking over at Everton if he wanted to.
Everton's a big job.
It is a big job, but it's not as big a job as Arsenal, although Everton fans may disagree.
All criticism to at B. Glendening on social media. In the Football League, lots of postponements because of that there weather. The big winners in the Championship were Fulham. They won 2-1 at Derby. Either side could have won it. Another goal for Ryan Sessegnon and one for on loan Alexander Mitrovic. Fulham overtake Derby into fourth. Bristol City are sixth after a 4-0 win over Sheffield Wednesday. Bobby Reid with a hat-trick. You got a draw, Barry, at Millwall. Sunderland, you didn't go out away at Millwall and get a point. Burton didn't play, and Birmingham also stay in the relegation zone after defeat at Nottingham Forest. Birmingham have appointed Gary Monk as their new manager, following Steve Cottrell's sacking after five straight defeats. I mean, Sunderland is a basket case, but what Birmingham have done since sacking Rowett has been quite an extraordinary... It's a great exhibition of really messing up when you just didn't have to.
Yeah. Just it's inexperienced owners. And people coming in thinking they've got a sort of, you know, they know, it's just ridiculous. And you're going to see more of these things like it. I mean, it's similar to what's happened at West Brom.
Big game in League One was yesterday. Top of the table, Blackburn drew 2-2 with third place Wigan at Ewood Park. Wigan coming back from two goals down. Second place, Shrewsbury didn't play. So Blackburn have 73 from 36 games. Shrewsbury 68 from 34. Wigan 67 from 32.
Four games in hand. That's quite... Is that good or is that...
Well, I don't know about you, but when I look at four games in hand, I add on 12 points.
Yeah.
There's nothing else is going to happen. We're going to win all those games, yeah, for exactly. 100%. It never quite works out like that. MK Dons...
You really are one of life's optimists, aren't you, Max?
Barry, yeah. MK Dons were the only side in the relegation zone to play, and they lost to Bristol Rovers. In League Two, leaders Luton were hammered 1-1 at Cambridge United. Graham says, could you show a little love for Carlisle United? Four games, one in a row. They somehow beat the Cumbrian Weather and Grimsby 2-0 on Saturday. Here is some love. Barry, called you Gary. Barry, would you like to show some audio love for Carlisle United?
He's reluctant.
You don't have to.
I'm not reluctant. I mean, if they're doing well, I'm delighted for them. But, I told a woman once that I loved her and I didn't mean it, and I don't want to make that mistake with Carlisle, because that ended very badly.
Would you like to give us Fitbar Corner instead?
Yeah, I can give you Fitbar Corner. It was the
Fitbar
weather, obviously.
Fitbar Corner, sorry. I've got told off before for mispronouncing what? Fitbar.
Fitbar. There were four Scottish Cup quarterfinals. They all went ahead despite the rather inclement weather. Celtic beat Greenock Morton 3-0. Aberdeen drew 1-1 with Kilmarnock. Motherwell beat Hearts 2-1, and Rangers beat Falkirk 4-1. So the draw has been made, and Celtic will play Rangers in the semi-final.
and Motherwell will take on Aberdeen or Kilmarnock. So, and Celtic also play Rangers at Ibrox next week. Jason Cummings scored a hat-trick, his first career hat-trick for Rangers in their win over Falkirk. And Celtic, Scott Sinclair has been in and out of the team, and he was dropped for both games in the Europa League against Zenit and taken off at half-time against Morton yesterday, and was replaced by Odson Edouard, who sparked the game into life and got himself a goal. Moussa Dembele got the other two. And, yeah, so it looks like Scott Sinclair may be dropped for the Old Firm derby next weekend.
Thank you, Barry. In the She Believes Cup, England are unbeaten after two. They won 4-1 against France on Thursday, Phil Neville's first game in charge. And they came back from behind twice to draw 2-2 with Germany. Ellen White scored both, took her second very well. Could have won it late on. It is worth watching the goals, because Germany's second is an absolutely hilarious own goal.
Pinball.
Yeah, pinball, own goal, one of the best. And while we're on England and the FA, FA news, Martin Glenn, his latest, is calamity too far? Oh, anyway, he's been accused of using offensive language by comparing the Star of David with symbols, with the Nazi swastika and a picture of Robert Mugabe. he was discussing Pep and the yellow ribbon, and he said, "We don't want the Jewish Star of David swastika or ex-Zimbabwe leader Robert Mugabe on a shirt." The Jewish Leadership Council said the comment was in poor taste. The Star of David is on Israel's flag. It's on the national team shirt and the FA logo. The same cannot be said for the swastika or
picture of Robert Mugabe. Who goes around putting pictures of Robert Mugabe
Robert
on anything?
Robert Mugabe's face on...
Well, Robert Mugabe used to.
There is the Robert Mugabe coat, with lots of pictures of his face. But he didn't make the Zimbabwe team put his face on the shirt.
So is Martin Glenn saying basically that if England were playing Israel in a friendly at Wembley, Israel wouldn't be allowed to wear the Star of David?
He's apologised. He said, "I would like to apologise for any offence caused by examples I gave when referring to political and religious symbols in football, specifically in reference to the Star of David." Barney Ronay, "Odd, really. The only person I can see bringing politics into football in an offensive and damaging way is the chief executive of the FA." It's all from Poppy. I mean, yeah, the Poppy thing is the thing.
The FA arbitrarily decided that poppies were okay, and I have no problem with anyone wearing a poppy. I don't wear one myself personally, and increasingly the reason I don't wear one is because very objectionable people keep telling me that I should. And
it's not like you to be contrary in any...
Well, it's not contrary to, you know, stand up to poppy fascists. And, you know, the poppy, ironically, since it was given the A-OK and the thumbs up by the FA, has become an increasingly political symbol. And, you know, it's some people don't like it, others have no problem with it. I'm kind of indifferent one way or the other. But, yeah, I mean, just Martin Glenn, I don't... You know, people will probably call for him to be sacked over this. I think he's done worse. And we all say silly things, but he seems to say them with alarming monotony, you know, and also the whole politics. He's just signed up this brown nosy deal with Qatar, which I find thoroughly objectionable. But so,
and also, like,
he's not really in a position to be lecturing anyone else about politics.
But you can
football.
Say silly things, but if you're in a position of authority, you shouldn't say silly. I mean, like, we all say silly things, but if you're in a position of authority, it's sort of more important to not say silly things.
Yeah,
is it?
I mean,
or not?
I think in this occasion, like, it seems just stupid. I mean, it's like, what do you think the Star of David is? You know, do you think it's some sort of Jewish militant or the sign of the IDF or something? It's like it is on the flag, and it is a symbol of Judaism. I mean, that's just ignorant.
Yeah.
And you know what I think is also, so I think Barry's completely right. I think by making a sort of such a desperate claim to make the poppy a non-political symbol, they've allowed room for other people to claim political symbols as non-political symbols, and that's problematic for the FA. Finally, I just think they're, you know, I've been to a lot of FA events, and I find every time I've gone, I find them really well-intentioned, well-meaning, wanting to do the right thing. But for an organisation that's very focused on good PR, they do an awful lot of bad PR. you know, they're just quite, it just rings of incompetence at the end of the day in a lot of ways. And, you know, I know that a lot of really good people who work at the FA, and I feel sorry for them.
Yeah, because there are, it's a very good point. There are lots of really good people that are doing really important work. There's so much work done.
Yeah, women's football being a great case in point, I think, you know, and then any Aluko thing just kind of completely undermines it all.
It must be sad to, you know, to work there and you have to go in and sit in the office and read the next thing that's happened, sort of head in your hands. Anyway, presumably nothing has happened because of that.
As a matter of interest, did Pep Guardiola wear his yellow ribbon in the game against for the game against Chelsea?
The producer Jonathan tells me he did, yes.
Okay.
I was more focused on the game itself, but yeah, so he's maintaining his stance. So we will see how that plays out in the fullness of time. Right, that'll do for part two. In part three, we'll begin with Sid Lowe in Spain. If he answers his bloody phone. Welcome back to part three. Let's start in Spain with Sid Lowe. Sid, how are you?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, good. Where do we find you today?
You find me in Madrid, having come back from Barcelona last night.
Did you have a nice time in Barcelona?
I don't have a nice time. It's quite the right word. I had a little bit of a run on to get to the station, so it's fair to say I was sitting there in a bit of a sweaty heap by the time I made it to the train.
Barcelona 1, Atletico 0. Simeone said that if Messi played for us, we would have won.
Yeah, and I particularly loved the way that he framed it, and this is what I've been writing about today, because he said this is like back in the barrio, meaning kind of the neighbourhood. In other words, you know, this is like it is on the playground. So the problem is that one person gets to pick, and they pick the best player first, and then the best player is playing for them. And he said, if Messi had been on that side, it might well have been different. And then I suppose that's the inevitable focus after this game, because it was tight, because it was 1-0, because it was won by an absolutely brilliant Messi free kick. By the way, it's a third game in a row he scored a free kick, which is a record in La Liga. It's three in a week, and all of them in different places. One under the wall to the near post, one thumping into the far corner, this one up and down to the near post again, and just brilliant. But I suppose that would be slightly unfair on the rest of the Barcelona players, because even if they're not the sparkling team that they once were, even if there's not that kind of collective flow about them that it once was, they're incredibly competitive. And actually, Simeone, in fairness to him, also talked about them as kind of having a bit of Atletico Madrid about them, and so did Valverde. You know, they're very well organised, they defend extremely well, they play 4-4-2 now. And I think there was a touch of kind of self-justification from Simeone there. He said, you know, they're proving that 4-3-3 in that beautiful style isn't the only way to play football.
It was Messi's 600th career goal. Does anyone take any notice of his records?
Yeah, they do. I mean, you're right. In a way, it sort of feels like they shouldn't, because they're falling every day. And some of them do get overlooked, in the sense that they happen very quickly and then people move on and another record falls the next day. And obviously with Messi and Ronaldo, this is kind of constant. But yeah, they do. And there's a lot of space to fill in four big sports newspapers. There's a drift at the moment, I think, over the last couple of years towards doing stories driven by milestones and records and stuff. So, yeah, of course they do. And it was noted that this was the 600th goal. And you know, it's quite impressive, isn't it?
It's a lot of goals, yeah.
It's a lot of goals. But the thing about Messi is, in a way, it's a lot of goals. And yet that would be to treat him as if he's a goal scorer. And actually, he's not really.
Yeah. God, that makes it even more annoying, doesn't it? When you think about it, how's Coutinho getting on?
I thought Coutinho, I mean, there's a sense of Coutinho when you watch him play stylistically, the touch and so on, that he has fitted in quite well with what Barcelona do, and that you know, there's the awareness of the ball, the technique, the passing ability. I think there is still a sense that he needs to take a little bit more of a step and perhaps take a little bit more control of games. But obviously, there's also a slightly uneasy kind of fit for him at the moment. Yesterday, for example, he played on the right hand side with Iniesta on the left. Until Iniesta went off injured, then he went over to that side, which is, I think, perhaps a slightly more natural fit. But there is a sense that despite the price, and despite the fact that it's early, and of course there could still be, you know, if he was to have a downturn now, I think at the end of the season people would say, I'm not sure about this guy. But the early sense, at least, is actually, wow, this he looks really does look like he could fit Barcelona's style. And although there is nothing quite like Andrés Iniesta, there is a little bit of a sense that maybe Coutinho can do some of the things that Iniesta did when, of course, Iniesta finally retires, because I think he's 33 at the moment.
Sid, there was speculation in the press over the weekend that Andrés Iniesta might go to Manchester City. Is that cobblers, or would there be any truth to it, do you think?
I just don't see it at all. I suppose, I mean, look, if Guardiola was to think that Iniesta had something to offer at a time when Barcelona don't, then I guess it is plausible. But I just don't see a scenario in which Barcelona are keen enough for him to go and he's keen enough to go for that to be plausible. I think if he does play anywhere after Barcelona, it will be, you know, without wanting to sound massively disrespectful, it would be the kind of the semi-retirement style thing. So maybe he goes to the US or perhaps he goes to China or somewhere like that. But I find it hard to imagine that he would go to England.
Real Madrid 3, Getafe 1. Gareth Bale scored 2 for Ronaldo. Ronaldo's 300th La Liga goal. Does anyone take any notice of Ronaldo's records anymore?
Yes, they do, yeah. As I say, you know, those two, it's just crazy, really, isn't it? The kind of records they keep on breaking and the number of goals they score. Ronaldo actually had a really, really slow start to the season in terms of goals in La Liga, but he's taken off since the turn of the year, and you know, the whole of Madrid feels kind of slightly rejuvenated by the arrival of the Champions League, which is where, of course, they know they can win something, because in La Liga they're miles behind and they long ago gave up the league title, even though Zidane keeps saying they haven't. And Ronaldo looks very, very good again. The other thing I think about Ronaldo, and this may be purely impressionistic, maybe it's the cut of the kit or whatever it may be, I think he looks slightly slimmer than he did. I think he looks a little bit stripped down. I mean, obviously, he's still big and powerful and athletic, but I think he looks ever so slightly more agile than he did before.
Did he do veganuary, do we think?
Does he do what?
Veganuary is, I don't know if it's unlikely to have reached your ham garage, but yeah, it's been a hipster London thing, going vegan okay. for January.
Oh, right. I don't know if he's done that. I doubt it, but who knows?
And obviously, Real PSG, that's their season right there, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's been the focus, and you can see that as well. I mean, to give you an example, and obviously this is partly a reflection of the nature of the bias of the sports papers, but you've got Marca and AS, the two very, very big national sports newspapers, obviously Madrid-driven, but still national sports papers. So yesterday you've got the game that everyone is saying is going to decide the league title, and Marca led on a fundamentally irrelevant victory over Getafe because it was about the focus towards Paris Saint-Germain, and the headline I think was Cristiano Ronaldo goes to Paris with a pair meaning a pair of, you know, a certain part of your anatomy, but also the pair of goals. And then today AS, off the back of the game, which is supposedly deciding the league, has gone with a headline about Modric and Cruz. So that tells you that, you know, this is huge, and everything has been about Paris Saint-Germain for a very, very long time now. Madrid have got Marcelo back, Modric and Cruz not fit enough to play at the weekend, but now back in training. So there's a hope more than a suspicion that at least one of them will be able to play in Paris. For what it's worth, it wouldn't be a huge surprise if Bale doesn't.
The Girona story goes on. Seventh now. They beat Villarreal 2-0 to close the gap to the Europa League places.
Yeah, it was actually not a great performance from Girona, but what they've done is extraordinary. At this stage of the season, 11 games to go, I think. No newly promoted team has ever been better placed than Girona are now.
Sid, thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Sid Lowe out in Spain. From there, and before we go to my boulangerie, we can catch up with Archie Rintutt, who is reporting on the Bundesliga live from Lukas Podolski's kebab shop.
So, in the Bundesliga this weekend, we had Bayern tearing Freiburg apart 4-0 on Sunday. Thomas Müller, just getting into a good run of form ahead of the World Cup, scored one and set up another two here. And spurred on, he said, by the fact that one of his horses gave birth to a foal on Saturday. Sadly for the Bundesliga as a spectacle, just the one horse in the title race. That's Bayern, who need just 8 points from their remaining 9 games for the title. Because for the 14th weekend out of 15 since Bayern went top in October, the team behind them in second didn't win. That was Borussia Dortmund this time, who travelled to Leipzig. And there had been a lot of chat during the week about Dortmund sporting director Michael Zorc telling the squad after their disappointing draw with Augsburg on Monday that they'd played like civil servants. Funnily enough, the German Civil Servants Union hit back at Zorc later in the week. Dortmund, though, did react on the pitch too in Leipzig. Both they and Leipzig, actually, have been playing below par of late, but this was a really good game. Finished 1-1, Jean-Kevin Augustin for Leipzig, Marco Reus for Dortmund, whilst the away side's on-loan Chelsea forward Michy Batshuayi fluffed a sitter in the second half. So, that leaves Leipzig 6th. And Dortmund 3rd in the Schneckenrennen, snail's race for the Champions League, as it's been described over here. Just 4 points between 2nd and 6th, with Schalke up to 2nd after they beat Hertha 1-0. Then you have Leverkusen in fifth after beating lowly Wolfsburg, but surprise package, Eintracht Frankfurt round off the top four after they beat Hannover 1-0. So, to the bottom, you had a huge game between 17th placed Hamburg and the team above them in the relegation playoff, that's Mainz. Still 8 points between them after a goalless draw, pretty much down to Mainz's third choice goalkeeper, Florian Müller, who had a dream debut, including a penalty save too. Hamburg fans with banners calling their players mercenaries and another saying that they're yet to see any football this season. Ouch. Cologne then could have moved off the bottom, but despite dominating against Stuttgart, they somehow conspired to lose 3-2. Goalkeeper Timo Horn with a game-changing howler. Poor old Cologne.
Do you think we should get Archie at the end of the report to go, Archie Rintut for The Guardian in Cologne? Like to end the report like a BBC News.
I thought he was in Lukas Podolski's kebab shop.
That's in Cologne.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
From Lukas's kebab shop to my boulangerie, welcome all. Angel Di Maria keeping up his Neymar tribute act. He got the fourth goal, his fourth goal in four games as PSG beat Troyes. PSG rested a few players ahead of the return leg with Real Madrid on Tuesday. They started with Julian Draxler up front and Timothy Weah, the 18-year-old son of George, came on for his first team debut. They're 14 points clear at the top of Ligue 1. Second place Monaco also won 2-1 over Bordeaux on Friday night. Marseille are in third and the final Champions League slot. They needed a last-minute equaliser to get a point at Nantes. They're 5 points ahead of Lyon, who, with a draw at Montpellier, extended their winless run in the league to six games. And Angers beat Guingamp 3-0. This game notable because the goals came in the first, 89th and 90th minutes. Feedback corner, everybody.
So, can I... Just that stat reminded me of something. Troy Deeney scored his 300th league goal for Watford at the weekend. And I think he's also scored on his 50th, 100th, 150th, 200th and 250th league appearances.
You get that because I said Troy Deeney? He could play for them.
He could.
Yeah. Are you with me? As many times before, no. Feedback corner, Alex says, there were lots of positives and negatives to our road trip podcast last week. Alex says, please adapt the story of the pod's perilous return from the snowbound caverns of Dublin into a television miniseries. I have no idea who would play Barry, Gabriel Byrne or Aidan Gillen. Although I would worry what the effects of becoming that dour for the part would do to them in the long run. Would be interested to hear casting suggestions for the rest of you. Well, obviously Ben Affleck would play me.
Why?
Because of the uncanny resemblance.
I think Colin Meaney should probably play me.
Okay.
Or Brendan Gleeson.
What about Barney? Hugh Grant?
Yeah.
This is an expensive cast you're lining up here.
And who plays
I'm
Wilson?
Sure we've got the budget for it.
I don't know who could play Wilson. Is Dustin Hoffman in the sort of Rain Man? You've got Hoffman, Affleck, Grant, and who was your one?
Donald Gleeson or Colin Meaney.
James says on the photo of us, leather jacket and a fag, going back to who is the bad boy of the Football Weekly pod, Barry.
Not a leather jacket.
Oh. So you're the good boy of the pod?
I'm just amazed I got a fag lit on the deck of that ferry in a hurricane.
Anyway, that'll do for today. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paolo.
Cheers.
Thanks, Baz. Back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
I'm Archie Rintut, reporting for The Guardian from Lukas Podolski's Kebab House.